attacked. All the men are described as being Asian. Specially trained officers are supporting the girl while inquiries are carried out. Uniformed officers are also undertaking additional patrols in the area.
Police searching for a man from Hampshire who's been missing for 6 weeks say they found a body. 22-year-old Kyle Heyman failed to return from a walk in Waterlooville on May the 18th. Sunni militants in Iraq are reported to have beaten back government forces trying to recapture Tikrit, the birthplace of Saddam Hussein. Troops are said to have withdrawn to a town 15 miles to the south. Heavy casualties have been reported on both sides. Fire damaged the derelict former Aylesbury United FC clubhouse at Buckingham Road in the town. Fire crews from Aylesbury and Waddesdon attended the incident shortly before 6 o'clock last night. Pupils at a school in Milton Keynes have been chosen as ambassadors for the Rugby World Cup. Three games will be played at Stadium MK during the tournament next year. Glenn Martins, the head teacher of Shenley Brook End, and says it's an honour to be among the 14 schools chosen across the country.
As the excitement grows more and more nearer the events, we want to capitalise on that and look at the sporting activities that go on both during and afterwards, because they're introducing it with tag rugby, touch rugby, so actually it can be a non-contact sport as well. And so it's about health, sport, as well as the full physical contact.
Elsewhere in sport, at the World Cup today, Mexico faced the Netherlands at 5, while it's Costa Rica against Greece at 9 o'clock. Host Brazil will face Colombia in the quarterfinals on Friday evening. And the weather for Bedsarts and Bucks, sunny spells with a chance of a sharp shower for most parts before it becomes dry again by this evening. The maximum temperature, 18 degrees Celsius, that's 64 degrees Fahrenheit. Get the latest news and sport online at bbc.co.uk/3counties.
BBC Three Counties Radio's big tour of Beds, Hearts and Bucks.
It's happy, it's positive, there's lots of people, there's lots of things going on. It's just charming.
It's all about where you live.
It's still got a real community, you know.
And all this week we're featuring Welling and Digswell.
It's a very sociable place.
But everything you're likely to want, cafes, restaurants.
The big tour of Beds, Hearts and Bucks. BBC Three Counties Radio.
Hello and a very warm welcome to Shrink Wrap. My name's Toby Friedner.
And I'm Dr. Chetna Kang. And coming up on this week's show, we're taking a closer look at gender dysphoria.
We're going to meet one of the country's leading gender experts who will explain what it is and why it happens.
We'll also hear from Samantha and Sunny from Hertfordshire, who have both changed genders, and from a national charity which supports transgender people.
And that's all coming up between now and two.
Across Beds, Hearts and Bucks.
This is BBC Three Counties Radio.
So let's kick off the show with the basics. Let's first go to Dr. James Barrett, who is a consultant psychiatrist and the lead clinician for the Charing Cross National Gender Identity Clinic.
James, thank you for joining us.
Hello, James.
Describe, first of all, what the different gender identity disorders are.
All gender identity disorders essentially consist of gender dysphoria, and what's meant by that rather general term is a sense that your own sense of maleness or femaleness doesn't fit your body and the sex you were assigned at birth.
And do we understand what causes it?
The short answer is no, although we've got some fairly good ideas about what doesn't. It seems to have no particular connection with how you were raised. It doesn't seem to have any particular connection with whether you were sexually abused in childhood. It doesn't seem to have any particular connection with social class. It seems to occur all around the globe with more or less the same rate wherever you go. It's not caused probably by environmental factors. There may be a genetic contribution to some extent, but in common with most conditions to which any human beings are heir, really, there's probably not one cause.
In terms of the number of things that come together, is it more likely to be genetic?
There's a genetic component.
Mm-hmm.
One can do quite complicated statistical studies that suggest that that's the case. But having said that, finding two people in the same family with the same problem is very rare.
Right.
There does seem to be more than a chance association with Asperger's syndrome and autistic spectrum disorders. They seem to show up more often in a gender identity clinic than you would expect by chance. But then having said that, most people with autistic spectrum disorders don't have gender identity problems, mm-hmm. and most people with gender identity problems don't have autistic spectrum disorders.
So when might someone first experience gender dysphoria or this kind of mismatch between their sense of femaleness or maleness?
There's not kind of one route into this situation, mm-hmm. and it can vary. For a fairly small proportion of people, it's been very evident and very apparent from when they were small children, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 years of age. For a greater proportion of patients who were assigned male at birth, actually early childhood was fairly unremarkable. And there may have been some wearing of female clothes, which isn't in and of itself a particularly unusual thing, but that intensifies at puberty, sometimes with some sexual arousal, and then fairly quickly the sexual arousal goes, and people are spending often many years of their life living part of their time in a male role and part in a female role, and then as time goes on begin to feel more themselves and more real when they're living as women, and at that stage they might turn up at this clinic.
James, thanks very much indeed for that for now. We'll come back to James Barrett a little bit later on in the programme.
So let's meet our first guest. Joining us in the studio are Samantha Williams, who is from Hertfordshire and experienced confusion about her gender growing up.
And we also have Janet Scott, who's from Luton and was president of the Beaumont Society from 1989. And we'll find out what the Beaumont Society is in a few minutes.
Good afternoon to you both. Thank you so much for joining us. Now, Samantha, can we start with you, first of all?
Okay.
You were born male.
Yes.
Okay, as far as you recall, as a child, you were a boy. When do you first remember feeling different from the other boys?
I think I can remember feeling different from about 5 or 6. But I wasn't really sure why. I think I just didn't. I didn't feel like I fitted in with a male role at school. And I enjoyed playing with girls more. I didn't really want to play with the boys. We had segregated playgrounds then. So you couldn't actually play mixed boys and girls. So I always felt like I was on the wrong side of the fence, if you like.
What was it that you felt uncomfortable with the boys? Was it way they interacted or what they did? Do you remember?
Yeah, I felt like I was just not... It didn't come naturally to me to fit in with my peers. And I didn't really know why at that age. It just didn't feel right, and I wasn't aware of why it didn't feel right.
Right, OK. So it was just nothing to do with gender at the time for you.
No,
for you, it was just,
no.
I just don't fit in.
I just didn't fit.
You know, there are lots of boys that don't feel like that at school and prefer to play with dolls and, you know, dress up as princesses and things.
Yeah.
When, at what point did it become a problem, I suppose, and make you feel negatively about it?
I think the older I got, the closer I got towards puberty, I started to realise that there was probably more... I think I was quite effeminate and I didn't realise that, and not that that's a reason for gender dysphoria, but I think I remember my mum saying things about behaviours and actions I had that were effeminate, and I shouldn't be doing that. It wasn't what boys did.
Can you give me an example?
Probably just the way I played and the way I reacted to things. I think not in a very male way, in a stereotypical boy. I mean, I look at my son and the way my son reacts to things definitely wasn't the way I was when I was younger at all. I was more like my daughter, if I could compare the two of us together. But I think probably my actions, and I didn't even realise, were probably giving away a lot to my mum. Not so much my dad. My mum probably picked up on things that it made her uncomfortable, and I didn't realise I was doing them.
And when did you first start thinking to yourself, I want to change?
The thing is, I remember a documentary called A Change of Sex. I think it was on one of the BBC channels, I think early 80s. And that was like an epiphany moment for me because I knew nothing about transgender at all. I didn't even know what the term was. And I saw that and I thought, oh, my God, that's you. That's exactly how I am. And it clarified how I felt.
So you were what, in your late teens at this point?
Oh, I was probably around about 15, 16 at the time.
Was that a moment of clarity and happiness, or was it a moment of, oh no?
It was an oh no, definitely oh no. With my family, it was definitely something that I could not have turned around and said, you know, I feel like I should have been born a girl. That would have been worst thing in the world. Definitely.
And at that point, what happened psychologically to you?
I think it opened up a floodgate in a sense, because I think it clarified how I felt, and that was more frightening than feeling that you're not correct but not knowing why. Sometimes when you find out why, and it's such a big thing and you don't know what to do, I think there wasn't any awareness, as far as I knew, of LGBT issues or people so much then, as you would say for younger people now, which is massively different. There was no Google, no internet. You couldn't just go and research
something.
So
you were on your own.
Yeah, literally. I had no other siblings, so I didn't have anyone else to open up to, and my parents were a definite no-no. So in school, no way.
So how long did you have to bottle it all in?
Realistically, until I was 44.
So how did you live your life?
That's 25 years of keeping that to yourself.
Yeah.
Those feelings of just totally being out of place in your own skin.
Yeah.
What happens in your head? Tell us how you feel in that position.
I think I felt like I was pushing myself and being pushed into a role that I had to play. Found it increasingly harder to do, almost like you're doing a permanent acting role for a film or a play that's your life, but it isn't your life. It's your life that you
must
don't
be
want.
Exhausting.
It's very stressful. Incredibly stressful.
I mean, the next 25-30 years you spent, you're saying, living a life that on the inside didn't feel real to you.
Yeah,
how
correct.
Did you live? What did you do for the next 30 years?
I think I did everything that. Probably overly male. I was a police officer, very physical. I was very into a lot of very physical exercise, distance running. Not that that's overly a male thing, but I think I used that to try and deal with stress and just to make myself so tired that I switched off for a while, and it was the only way I could clear my head was actually running for clarity. I think it was just a downward spiral, and it got to a point.
You became Forrest Gump.
Yeah, literally.
running.
Yeah, literally.
You made reference to your son and daughter earlier. Did you have children in that time?
Yes, I did. Now, more recently, they're both under six, so not that long
more
ago.
More recently, okay.
I came out to my wife, crazily enough, 3 weeks before the birth of our son, which was... There's no good timing, but I think it was just... It was going to come out, and I'd said to her and friends that if I hadn't have told her then, it would have come out talking about Tesco's or something, writing the shopping list, and, by the way, I think I'm transgender. And it would have been almost a feeling like my internal voice had come out, and you'd be thinking, did I say that? I hope I didn't say that. Oh, my God, I did say that.
Was she the first person you told?
Yeah. I'd not spoken to anybody at all, ever. Yeah. Through shame and self-disgust and self-loathing and very, very negative feelings about the whole thing, and something that I didn't want to face up to, and I couldn't face up to.
What did she do?
She was incredibly shocked. Not in a bad way. I think initially she was very concerned. She was concerned that I'd dealt with something for that long, and obviously my mental health wasn't amazing at the time. She always knew that I was sort of keeping something back, if you like. Not that big, obviously, but she took it better than I would have thought, but then probably took about 6 months for that to really hit her, and then it started to get slightly difficult then. Well, we are still together, but...
It's wonderful that you're still together, and, you know, it's testament to both your courage. You know, you are the most courageous person I think I've ever met.
I wouldn't go that far.
when you know, they say that you only get a sense of what it feels like to be something if you walk in that person's shoes.
True.
So I couldn't possibly understand what was going on in your head at the time. But you've given us a good idea of how it felt. But you know, and you've got this far, and you're still together, and you're still living as a family.
Yeah, yeah. It's different. We're a different family, but we're still a family.
What's it like for your children?
My son doesn't know any different, which is a great thing. Some people would say not, but I think it's a great thing.
When you say he doesn't know any different, does he call you both mummy or does he...
Oh, mummy.
You're mummy. Both mummy.
He mixes between mummy and Samantha, and then so does my daughter, so he's copying her, really. So,
okay.
My daughter swings more to mummy now unconsciously. And it was always Samantha originally, because we gave her a choice and what
she obviously remembers you as daddy.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
What was that conversation like? How did you do it?
How old was she? That was 2 years, over 2 years ago now.
So she was only three.
Yeah, she was only three, so she didn't really have that much of awareness. She'd say, oh, mummy's got a top like that, or is that mummy's jumper, is that mummy's jacket? She didn't really have that awareness. I think she just... But at that age, I suppose children are just coming into the awareness that there are gender differences and there are boys and girls, and she was just coming into that, and it was interesting. She's been really good, absolutely fantastic, and she's not had any negative...
Do you know what? I don't think it sounds like there's been any love lost on anyone's part. It sounds lovely.
No. It's more so, if anything.
What it shows is...
Just different.
Life's about relationships.
Mm. It is relationships,
and it doesn't matter who you are, what sex you are, what gender you are, do you know what I mean? If you love somebody, if you love them,
that bottom pulls you line. Through. Pulls you through a lot of things.
Absolutely. Yeah. I want to bring Janet Scott into the conversation now, if I may. Janet, you're from the Beaumont Society, aren't you? And tell us what the Beaumont Society is, first of all.
The Beaumont Society was formed in 1966, and it was set up as a support group for transgendered people. We're coming up to our 50th anniversary in 2 years' time, and we're now a registered charity. We are still very much a support group for the whole range of transgendered people. In the early days, it was quite straightforward. Transsexual, cross-dressers, transvestites. Mostly male to female.
And you know, so you're talking in the 60s.
Yeah.
And they were looked on as deviant, weren't they, at that time? And something to laugh at, perhaps?
Oh, yeah. I mean, when I spoke to my doctor in 1960 and said I like to wear girls' clothes, he said, oh, you're a transvestite. So I went home to my new wife and said, oh, the doctor called me a trans something or other, because she was expecting our first child. And I looked it up in the Oxford Dictionary, and it described it as a sexual deviant behaviour and a perversion. And my wife thinks, oh my God.
My married
new
to a
husband,
pervert.
Yeah, and the father of my new baby, and he's a sex pervert. So we better go and get cured. So I went through aversion therapy to find the cure.
Goodness me.
What? And were you cured?
Yeah, absolutely. I don't dress as a man at all anymore.
What was that like? What happens when you go for aversion therapy?
Ironically...
I'm sorry to make you relive
no,
this.
No. I mean, it was back in 1960, 61, so it's a long time ago. Ironically, I went to see this consultant psychiatrist, and he had a clinic, an experimental clinic under the NHS, in Fulham Palace Road, which is where Charing Cross Hospital now is. Charing Cross Hospital back then was in Charing Cross. So I used to go along to this clinic. I would take a selection of female clothing, which I would then put on. He would then give me an injection in my rump that made me violently sick and ill, while he told me what a disgusting person I was. Oh. And He showed me photographs of men dressed as women, but they were the most gorgeous looking women you ever saw. You know, these were the girls from the Paris cabaret scene, and they were absolutely gorgeous. Now, this was supposed to put me off dressing as a woman. And the reason I kept it up for as long as I did was because it was an opportunity to officially be able to dress up as a woman in front of other people. Anyway, I told my wife I'd been cured eventually, and the baby was born, our son. who's now 53.
You don't look old enough, Janet.
Clever makeup.
Yes,
clever
makeup. It is.
And, anyway, and so I convinced my wife and everybody else I've been cured for about 4 or 5 years. And then my wife discovered that I hadn't been cured and I was secretly dressing still.
Janet, you speak about it quite lightheartedly.
That's the only way.
At the time, you know...
Remember, I was born in 1934, so it was a different world back then. Yeah. And remember, the word transvestite only came into use in 1933, the first time it was used. But the word transvestite still has connotations of its original description of sexual deviant behaviour. So we try not to use that word these days because it's a word that we find uncomfortable. So for me, growing up in the 30s and 40s, I started school at the beginning of the Second World War, and I was finishing school at the end of the Second World War. My first recollection of somebody who had similar feelings to me that I couldn't explain to anybody was Roberta Cowell, who went through gender reassignment surgery in Casablanca in 1952-53.
And she was the woman that... There was obviously a big media splash.
Oh, yes.
And everybody was shocked, and it was society, and everyone went, oh, my goodness, who is this freak?
Ironically, she got a lot more positive publicity in those days, with a big spread in the Picture Post and the newspapers, than girls that come along much later in the 60s and 70s, where the press become quite abrasive, and they still are, to be honest. So, you know, they were the things that, for me, it made me begin to think that there were other people similar to me, but I couldn't relate to them because I was definitely attracted to girls. And at the same time, I wanted to dress as a girl, so... It was so confusing. If I want to dress as a girl, and why am I sexually attracted to girls? So for me, it was a case of, do I get into a Nichols or wear the damn things?
let's go back to James Barrett, who's the lead psychiatrist at the Charing Cross Gender Identity Clinic. James, this may sound like an obvious question, but talk me through what actually happens during gender reassignment surgery, say going from a man to a woman?
There's usually a couple of appointments where the clinicians involved try to figure out what's up with the person and also find out whether it's safe to treat them with hormones if that becomes an issue later. For some people, that can be a kind of a quick process, particularly people who've already been living as a woman for a number of years or who were assessed at a child gender clinic as children. Sometimes it's not that straightforward, and there are patients with either complicated social circumstances or a complicated history, and it might need another third opinion or sometimes some more thought even than that. If it looks like it's a sensible thing to proceed, and if the patient's happy to do so, and if they're actually safe to treat with estrogens, then that's what occurs. And they have estrogens have a reasonable degree of feminizing effects. Most people can expect some breast growth. It doesn't have any particular effect on facial hair, so people will need electrolysis or laser hair removal. Clearly, it's not going to change anybody's height. It doesn't change anybody's voice, and speech and language therapy, which is part of the services that's offered at this and other clinics, is usually needed to address that. Surgery isn't usually needed. Speech and language therapy usually does the job. But if that doesn't work out, surgery is a possibility to change people's pitch of voice. And there are ongoing appointments with that particular clinic, usually with a fairly consistent person, if the patient's happy with that. And the key thing is that people have got to not just survive, but thrive. If people feel better and do better living as a woman all of the time, then that's something that suggests that this is going to run in the long term and give a kind of permanent enhancement to their quality of life. And if people managed to do that for a reasonable period of time, which is never less than a year, typically more like about two, then at that stage, if they are physically fit to operate on, they're likely to be referred for gender reassignment surgery.
And then what about the other way?
The beginning of the process is fairly similar. If it's felt, you know, the clinical judgment is that it's reasonable to treat people with male hormones, and if the patient is happy with that, then male hormones are given. They're usually given by injection, not tablets, and they cause people's voice to decrease in pitch. They'll get hairy if their genetic endowment, you know, is that of somebody who's hairy. Good idea is to look at your brother and see if he's hairy. They'll go bald if there's baldness running in the family. Clearly, they're not going to get any taller. Might get a little musclier. Again, weight gain's a problem. Both estrogens and androgens increase appetite. And so if people aren't careful what they eat, then they're likely to get fat.
James, it sounds like there's a lot of preparation, on many levels before someone's ready for surgery. Now, yeah. The surgery itself, both ways, male to female, female to male, how functional and how successful is the surgery, really?
That rather depends what you're expecting to do with the result.
Right.
Surgery to make female genitalia is very successful. The results are really very good. Surgery for patients who are assigned female at birth is much, much more difficult to do. It's multiple stage surgery, and the results rather depend on what the patient wants. Some people wish to acquire something like a penis so that they can pass urine standing up, and that's the thing that most troubles them. For other people, it's something that will look all right in a changing room. For other people, again, it's going to be what would be useful for sexual intercourse. So it's, and different sorts of surgery do different sorts of things. And the more of those things you're expecting the surgery to do, the more complicated the surgery will be that can achieve that. It's of note that only about a third of the born female patients in the clinic actually undergo surgery to make something like a penis, because it's a lot of surgery. And for most of them, they've got very successful, thriving lives as men, usually with a very satisfactory relationship with some straight woman. And it's going to take a huge chunk out of their lives having all of this surgery. And whilst they wouldn't mind being in the position of having had it, they just don't have the kind of time and energy to go through the process of having it.
James Barrett, thank you.
You're listening to Shrink Wrapped with Dr. Chetna Kang and Toby Friedner. And this week, we're taking a closer look at gender dysphoria.
Nick Coffer, across Beds, Hearts and Bucks.
I'm at Bletchley Park today for a very, very important special occasion.
For me, being out of the studio is about putting faces to names and bringing to life all that's brilliant about Beds, Hearts and Bucks.
If you know the high street here and you've never seen what goes on behind you, you really should, because it's like a whole new world.
Nick Coffer.
I think for my listeners, they get a chance to hear about places they may never have visited. In fact, they may never have heard of. And also, they hear the stories from the people that bring those places to life.
That is one of the mysteries of Abbots Langley Fire Brigade.
Nick Coffer, across Beds, Hearts and Bucks on BBC Three Counties Radio.
Travel news for Beds, Hearts and Bucks.
BBC Three Counties Radio.
Let's start with the trains. A reduced service is running today on East Coast via Stevenage into and out of London King's Cross for regular weekend maintenance to take place. Chiltern Railways, they're revised between Aylesbury Vale Parkway and Marylebone. Replacement buses running via Amersham. And to the roads now, the A1 Watford Way, that's looking busy southbound between Apex Corner and Mill Hill Circus still. I'm Nikki Brighton for BBC Three Counties Radio.
The next travel bulletin is in 30 minutes.
BBC Three Counties Radio. This is Shrink Wrapped
on BBC Three Counties Radio.
You're listening to Shrink Wrap for a Sunday afternoon, and joining us in the studio is Samantha Williams from Hertfordshire, who experienced gender dysphoria and is in the process at the moment of transforming a man to a woman, and Janet Scott, who's from Luton and is a former president of the Beaumont Society, which is a support group for people who are transgender. Samantha, you have chosen to go down the surgery route, haven't you?
Yes, I have, yeah.
Why is that?
I feel like that's right for me. I think it's not right for everybody, but for me, that is the end result that I'm looking for. I think that will bring everything into line with me, mentally and physically.
When we were speaking to James Barrett earlier on, he was talking about how your voice can be changed with speech. So, yeah. Did you have to go, because your voice, I mean, people can't see you, but they can hear that your voice is quite high pitched.
Yeah.
Did you have to have speech therapy?
Yes,
for that?
Yeah, okay. I have. I had that at the Charing Cross GIC. That was very good. It was worth a 5-month wait for an appointment for that. Yeah.
And how long did it take?
I had 7 sessions, and I it is available to have more, but I've got childcare issues, so I can't go to those.
I mean, when I think of speech and language therapy, as do most people, they think about it dealing with lisps or stutters.
Yeah.
You know, talk us through what you might have gone through to change your voice from being deep to now something that's, you know, a voice that's relatively high. Is it something you put on? Is it now your natural voice?
Over time, it becomes more natural, and it becomes something that you don't think about doing. Initially, it's a work in progress all the time, and you have to concentrate on how you're wording things. You can use a cue to get your pitch. I naturally say quite a lot in conversation, and I use that as a pitch to get that initial...
It's like an impressionist,
yeah,
isn't
yeah,
it?
You know, yeah,
they've
yeah.
got to think of a word that yeah, brings to mind that particular accent.
Yeah.
And how far are you through the process?
I've been under Charing Cross for just over a year now. And I don't know. There's no set time, really. I probably to the end of mine, anything up to maybe another 5 years. I don't know. I'm being optimistic. I'm not sort of expecting it to happen tomorrow. Mm. So,
and what was the experience of going through taking the hormones, or is what's that like?
For me, it was a very calming effect. If anything, it was like, I think I'd spent most of my life feeling in a fog, if you can say, like a mental fog, and I started taking HRT and that fog just dissipated. And it was the first time I think I've had clarity of thought ever in my adult life to say I could actually think and feel comfortable. I think everywhere I went, I felt uncomfortable, and I didn't feel comfortable in social situations in any way. And after about a month on estrogen, I could actually go to places and feel calm and feel correct in myself, which I'd never had. And it was amazing.
What about social circumstances now? You know, you must take the kids to school, or your daughter to school.
Yeah, yeah, I do the school run, school pick-up. I share that with my wife, so we do that between us. But it's an experience, yeah. Definitely.
And at school, are you Samantha Williams as well?
Call
you Mrs. Williams?
Mostly Samantha.
Mostly Samantha, okay.
Yeah, I mean, I'm full-time everywhere I go now, so...
What do you mean it's an experience, a negative experience?
It's a mixed bag, really, because some people... I think if you'd always gone into a situation presenting as female, people don't know you any differently and they take you as you are, and they'll either be okay or they won't be. When you've been daddy one week and mummy the next, that's something else, and you find out who's open-minded, and you find out who really isn't... It weeds out the people that you don't want to be talking to, and they don't want to talk to you.
Do people ever get openly abusive?
I've had hate mail. I got hate mail from some parents at my daughter's school, basically accusing me of being a paedophile because I'm transgender. And, you know, don't come anywhere near our children. That was quite upsetting, and it was frightening as well. I've had a few silly comments from parents, unnecessarily so, really.
How do you deal with it?
At the time, I did my very best to ignore it. I went home and got very upset, as you do. And I was afraid to go back to the school again, especially after we received the letter. That was very frightening. and it made me incredibly uncomfortable, incredibly frightened of going back to pick my daughter up. We had to put her in after school classes for 2 weeks after because I wouldn't go back to the school. Not a very good experience, no.
But. Janet, what's it going to take? I mean, you'll never convince everybody, will you?
No.
But you know, things like that are based on fear, aren't they? Fear of what people don't know, don't understand.
I think I should say at this point, transphobia is a criminal offence. And if any transgender people listening to this programme feel that they are being victimised because they're transgendered, go to your local police because they can deal with it. Whether it's hate mail, with street abuse, physical attacks on your person or your body or your car or your home, go to the police. They are geared to deal with it. Homophobic and transphobic is a criminal offence, and anybody found guilty of that can be sent to prison.
You were a police officer, Samantha. Did you ever deal with that kind of crime yourself?
Not transphobic specifically, but homophobic, yeah, definitely.
Samantha, you spoke about you are living 24/7 as Samantha.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So for all intents and purposes, you are Samantha. You're a female.
Yeah. Yeah, that's correct.
If for any reason the surgery couldn't happen, would that make a difference?
No. If you like, it's a part of you that only somebody very close to you will see anyway. Mm. It doesn't affect my transition or the rest of my life. It doesn't affect any other part of me other than physically, and that's who you choose to be physically close to. It wouldn't change the way I'm living my life. No, I'd still carry on as I am. It wouldn't make me think, oh, I want to go back to being a man again, because I never was anyway.
Mm. I remember when I was training with James Barrett, he did mention one of the... almost an acid test of knowing whether the transition is going to be successful and go well is when the actual surgery is just icing on the cake. It's not necessary anymore.
No, it's not. It doesn't help you pass. It doesn't make people think differently of you. It doesn't make people not think that you're transgender or, you know, it's...
Now, we've been speaking to Janet Scott from the Beaumont Society and Samantha Williams, who's from Hertfordshire, who has been changing gender from male to female. Joining us on the phone line now is Sunny Van Eden, who's also from Hertfordshire and has transitioned from woman to man. Welcome, Sunny.
Hello. Yep.
Hello. Try and explain to the listeners who may not have a clue about it what it feels like to have gender dysphoria.
It feels like my reflection is... or was before pre-medical transition, was actually lying to me, that my mind thought that I looked like I didn't. And I didn't really have the language or the understanding to know what it was, but I just didn't feel, something just didn't feel right at all.
I mean, Samantha mentioned that she noticed when she, something was different when she was a child. Was it similar for you?
Yeah, I think when I was 4, I said to my mum I should have been a boy, and I think that from there I just felt that I didn't understand who I was.
As time went on, how did what you were feeling in your head manifest itself?
My gender was very confused, so what I did, I used to wear male clothing, and then thought I'm a lesbian, so that's in practical aspects, that's how it was, but it never really, me identifying as a lesbian never really sorted out my gender. It just helped me understand my sexual orientation at the time. And then what happened was I started using or abusing alcohol, primarily, but drugs as well, to push my feelings down.
And at what point did you go, enough's enough, I am going to face the reality of the situation?
When the alcohol stopped working and it was no longer an option because I was physically addicted to it, so I went into a rehabilitation program and was able to then, for the first time, find an environment where I was able to learn to trust a counsellor and address my gender dysphoria feelings that were going on.
So what happened from then on?
from then on, I was able to access a medical pathway to, not correct, but try and address the mismatch of feelings and actual my body. So I started my journey to becoming the man that I am today.
Now, you know, we've been speaking to Janet and we've been speaking to Samantha. Janet's mentioned that people get transgender and being transvestite and cross-dressing, they bag everything together in one bundle. But it's very clear from what they're saying that actually the mismatch isn't anything to do with I like to wear women's clothes because I get a sexual, you know, kick from it or an orgasm from it, or it's not really so much to even to do with your sexual preference. It really is to do with your own gender identity and whether you're feeling male or female. And that's something that's it's probably the first thing that's assigned to us from birth. Even before kids are born, we're thinking, oh, should we get blue baby clothes or pink baby clothes? How was it manifesting for you in your life on a day-to-day basis, this mismatch, this discomfort?
Yeah, like you say, it's a given that you never challenge. So I think that for myself, I never challenged the concept of, well, I say it now, boy, girl.
Hmm.
It was total confusion, and there was, you know, I felt like I was a boy, but I was with the girls, if you see what I mean.
Sure, sure.
In any action that needed us to be divided into groups of different gender, so it was really confusing.
Hmm.
You've decided to go down the road of gender reassignment surgery, haven't you?
I'd call it affirming my gender, because I haven't reassigned I haven't had genital surgery, so some people would say that I've had chest surgery.
Right.
Yeah.
But what's been great is that you've had the option to do what has made you feel more like a man.
I think that, yeah, being given the option to choose the correct pathway for me in terms of transition was key to the success of me being who I am today.
And that was available to you on the NHS, and you were able to have that and go through all the therapy associated with that.
Yeah, I chose my surgery, and I've had a bilateral mastectomy
yeah.
with nipple grafts, and I'm waiting to get full hysterectomy and oophorectomy, which is the removal of all that bit down there.
Now, Samantha described that when she had the hormones, it cleared a fog and brought clarity to her, made her feel calm. Did you have a similar experience or a different experience when you started taking the testosterone? Did it, for you, reaffirm, as you described, or affirm your gender identity?
It did. It also come with difference as well, because I learnt to manage my emotional responses that were different.
Can you give us an example? Because I feel like, you know, male to female, people, you know, relatively come across more often, but female to male, we don't hear about so much. So tell us about this emotional response. How's it different?
Yeah. You know, that old thing of men and women being different. I think that I experienced that hormonally, because my the dominant sex hormone in my body changed from estrogen
mm-hmm.
to testosterone.
Mm-hmm.
And so what I remembered a point where I couldn't access an emotional response that I was used to, which is probably tears. Not saying that all women always cry, but for me, there was a certain amount of time, you know, once a month I might find some tears, but having my monthly stop, and then I found that I couldn't access that emotion. So the nearest emotion I found was a little bit of anger or frustration. So I think that for me, once I notice now that I'm a bit angry, maybe it's me crying, you know. And when a woman cries, I'm more empathic, because I think maybe she's angry. You know, it's a different way to respond to situations now.
I find that fascinating, that insight that you've had, that insight and that correlation.
Yeah.
I'm sure,
colours were more,
you know,
vivid.
Transgender or male or female, I think that would hit a, you know, chord with anyone listening.
Just before you go, Sunny, you're involved in some work now to try and improve the general health of trans people, aren't you? Tell us a bit about that.
Well, I tried to get to help people access services easier and smoother, so their route to transition was a smoother one, and eradicate any myths that were there, so that when they go to their GP, they're informed of the pathway, so that they can educate their GP on how to best care for them. So that helps any kind of frustration, you know, with the long journey they have ahead of them. That's why I did that. Yeah.
Well, I wish you luck with it, Sunny, and thank you very much indeed
thanks
for joining
so much,
us on the
Sunny.
Programme.
Oh, thanks a lot. Bye.
Bye-bye.
This is Shrink Wrapped
on BBC Three Counties Radio.
So, Janet Scott from the Beaumont Society, when you hear people like Sunny talking about their experience, what's going through your mind?
I think for the changes for female to male, the testosterone is quite dramatic. Facial hair develops, they get bald pattern, baldness developing, their muscles thicken up, their waist thickens up. Once they've had the breasts removed, that's a big step for them psychologically. And later on, when they have the womb removed, because they don't like to do it too early because of long-term medical problems. So for a lot of them, they just look like a lot of handsome young men. They got the male voice, you know, they got a beard or the moustache, whichever they want. They got that thicker waist that a man has. But I'm afraid going the other way, it's not quite so dramatic. And there's a lot of ugly women out there.
But look, you know, it's again, it's what makes you feel comfortable, isn't it?
Absolutely.
And you know, I'll just describe what you're wearing. And if you don't mind, I might put a picture of you up on our website, if that's all right.
Both of you.
I'm a Bon Marsh lady.
And there are some very nice clothes in Bon Marsh.
I bought this one in Luton.
Do you keep
Marsh.
Them in business then? Is that
absolutely? Yeah.
You've got your lovely pastel coloured
lilac jacket with
on your
matching floral
scarf, yes. And the dress
goes all the way through to the skin.
As I should hope so.
You know, like I said before, when I step out the bath, I look like my dad, or like my dad used to. And then when I go out through the front door, I look like me mum. See, I, for my own personal reasons, I chose not to go down the gender reassignment route. But I transitioned completely, technically, legally, mm-hmm. apart from physical changes, in 1992.
I mean, that's one thing we haven't really spoken about. We've spoken about the actual physical changes, hormonal, but in terms of life changes, you can change your name by deed poll. Even, I mean, I know one of the criteria with the clinic is that your employer has to send a reference stating that you've been working under your new name and new gender identity in that employment for at least a year. So these are all practical life issues that signify that you are living in your chosen gender identity.
Yeah. But, I mean, for me, my circumstances changed quite dramatically. Mm. In 1987, my wife died. And then 3 years later, my company who I worked for offered me early voluntary retirement. So at the age of 57, I took early retirement. And I left on the 31st of December, 1991. And then on the 5th of January, 1992, I legally became Janet Scott. And once I got those legal papers, I changed my driving license, medical cards, and everything else. So even the hospital called me in for a cervical smear.
Was that your proudest moment?
Absolutely. Well, they asked me to go in for a mammogram, and I said, well, I'm rather busy. Can I leave them at the front door?
just finally, Samantha, if that person that wrote that letter that you were describing earlier was sitting here now, that person that clearly doesn't get has no interest in, is frightened of you, what would you say to that person? And you can't swear.
That limits it quite a lot, actually. I think I'd like anybody like that to realise that it's not a choice. You don't choose to be trans, you don't choose to be straight, you don't choose to be gay, you don't choose to be a mix of trans and gay or anything at all. You are the person that you are. I don't choose to be me any more than they're choosing to be themselves every day. And I think if people understood that you are not going out of your way to impact on their life, and I don't. I am a private person. I don't impact on other people's lives. I change my life for me to have a life, to be a parent, to continue being a parent to my children, and to be a functional person, not to cause other people problems or to get under their skin or to be an object of ridicule or somebody to persecute. We all have things that we have to do, and they're not all choices.
It's been brilliant talking to you both. What I hope is people have come away with more of an insight and more of an understanding. Mm.
The final thing I would like to say is don't look at newspaper headlines, because they exaggerate the truth. They misinform the public at large.
Do they?
Absolutely.
I never knew. I mean,
recently, they were talking about sex change pills for 9-year-olds. If you could change sex by taking a pill, I think there's a lot of us to be taking that damn pill.
Janet Scott, Samantha Williams, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Well, I hope you've enjoyed the show. It's been fascinating. And thank you for staying with us for the hour. As we always do at the end of the programme, let's finish on a high.
I've got a story for you, Toby, about a king with 4 wives. Okay, he had 4 wives.
Henry VIII, was it?
No, it wasn't. I thought he had more than 4 wives.
He had 6.
He had 6, yeah. There we go. So this king had 4 wives. He loved his 4th wife the most. He gave her riches, robes, treated her to the finest delicacies, gave her nothing but the best. Also loved his 3rd wife very much, always showing her off to the neighbouring kingdoms, how beautiful she was. However, he did worry that one day she would leave him for another. Also loved his 2nd wife. She was his confidant, always kind, considerate, patient with him. Whenever the king faced a problem, he knew he could always discuss it with her and she would help him through the difficult times. And then there was the king's 1st wife, his very loyal partner, and had made the greatest contribution in maintaining his wealth and kingdom, and he couldn't have had anything he had without her. However, he didn't love his 1st wife. Although she loved him deeply, he hardly noticed her. One day the king fell ill, and he knew his time was short. He thought of all his luxuries and his life, and he wondered, I have 4 wives with me, but when I die, I'll be all alone. He thought, I wonder if one of them will come with me. So he asked his 4th wife, I've loved you the most. I've given you the most. Will you come with me now that I'm going? Will you follow me and keep me company? No way, she said, and she walked away without another word. Her answer cut like a sharp knife right into his heart. The sad king then asked his 3rd wife, I've loved you all my life, and now that I'm dying, will you follow me and keep me company? No, life is too good. When you die, I'm going to remarry. His heart sank and he turned cold. He then asked his 2nd wife, I've always turned to you for help. You've never let me down. You've been there for me through my most difficult times with good advice. Will you come with me? Sorry, I can't help you out this time, replied the 2nd wife. The very most, I can send you to your grave. Her answer came like a bolt of lightning, and the king was devastated. Then a voice called out, I'll leave with you and follow you no matter where you go. The king looked up, and there was his 1st wife. She was so skinny, as she had suffered from malnutrition and neglect. Greatly grieved, the king said, I should have taken better care of you when I had the chance. In truth, we all have these 4 wives in our life. Our 4th wife is our body. No matter how much time and effort we lavish in making it look good, it will leave us when we die. Our 3rd wife are our possessions, status, wealth. When we die, all of that will go to other people. Our 2nd wife is our family and friends. No matter how much they've been there for us, the furthest they can stay with us is up to the grave. Our 1st wife is us, our soul, our spirit, our true self, that inner self, often something we neglect in pursuit of wealth, power, and the pleasures of the world. However, that inner self of ours is the one thing that stays with us no matter what. So turn to your first wife once in a while and nourish her.
There's a reason for the sunshine sky, and there's a reason why I'm feeling so high. Must be the season when that love light shines all around us. So let that feeling grab you deep inside.
Radio's Big Tour of Beds, Hearts and Bucks.
A beautiful old village with a real community spirit.
And all this week we're featuring Welwyn and Diggswell.
It's a bit like Trumpton, the way it was.
Inviting everyone to where you live.
You can get out into the countryside and go walking, cycling, whatever. There's plenty going on.
You've got everything you're likely to want. Cafes, restaurants.
If you've got a story everyone should hear about, let us tell them about it.
Quiet country living in a really convenient location.
It really is a great little place to live.
The Big Tour of Beds, Hearts and Bucks from BBC Three Counties Radio.
Travel news for Beds, Hearts and Bucks.
BBC Three Counties Radio.
I've just had reports that the A5 is closed in both directions, northwest of Milton Keynes, between the A422 at Old Stratford and the High Street in Pontesbury because of an accident. Just checking the sensors, it is queuing towards the scene. I'm Nikki Brighton for BBC Three Counties Radio. Vocal across Beds, Hearts and Bucks.
This is BBC Three Counties Radio.
It's 2 o'clock. This is Nick Alliker. The University of Essex.